Welcome back to another edition of the Pistols Firing Podcast. It is Tuesday, and joining me, as always, is Kyle Porter, the founder of Pistols Firing Blog. Kyle, what's up, man?
Not much. We're in the let's talk about random things that mildly relate to Oklahoma State portion of the year.
Yeah, it's about that time. Game of Thrones coming up in April, but we do need to start with Oklahoma State basketball just for a little bit. They host Kansas tonight. If anyone knows how to beat Kansas, it's Oklahoma State and Gallagher Iba Arena. That goes back to the Sean Sutton era, and of course, Travis Ford's beaten him twice.
Yeah, isn't that odd? I think he's actually beaten him three times. I think it's like three times in the last 5 years in Gallagher Iba.
Oh, yeah, one in Lawrence, too, right?
Well, I think it's four out of six then, because they've won the last 2 years in Gallagher Iba. They won in, like, I think, 09 in Gallagher Iba. And then one of those years they also won in Lawrence. So that's pretty strange to me that you can't finish better than seventh in the Big 12, but you can beat Kansas on an annual basis.
I have two theories about this. Would you like to hear them?
Yeah, let's make it a murderer style. Let's do it.
Well, they both involved one suspect, and that's Bill Self. He's an alum of Oklahoma State. Part of him probably is one theory. My main theory, this is my primary theory, is he doesn't want Oklahoma State to get good again because it makes his job harder if OSU's good at basketball. So he kind of gives OSU a win, and it also kind of lights a fire under his own team. We've seen that loss in OSU in Stillwater propel Kansas further and end up winning the Big 12. That's one theory. The other theory is obviously he's an alum and just can't stand to see OSU basketball stink so bad. Do you buy any of those theories? But my first one's my main theory.
Is he also like buying up just legions of seats in Gallagher Iba to try and? I mean, I guess that would support both of those theories. He's financially supporting them and helping keep Travis Ford around. Because I think the main thing in all of this is you know, like we've discussed, like Mike Holder. Like, how does he see this situation financially? Not even what's happening on the court, but how that drives what's happening financially. So, is that part of the theory? Like, Self, like, has created all these pseudonyms and is buying up tickets and GIA and just not going. That's why nobody's showing up at the games.
No, that's an alternate theory. That's theory number three. We got so many theories going here. But no, I think part of it, he has a soft spot for OSU. I think the main part of it is that's like the one game of the year that Gallagher Iba is filled, and it's a tough place to play when Gallagher Iba is filled. So there's a lot of moving parts, and I honestly don't believe those theories I just threw out there. But it is kind of curious that Bill Self, the one team that he's struggled against is OSU, despite the fact that OSU hasn't been very good over the last 5-10 years.
Yeah, it's weird. I wrote about today a little bit, and Oklahoma State's main problem among a litany of problems is that, and Ford actually admitted this, and really, I think he said it meaning it positively, but I look at it as a negative. He said, we have to get all our guys as individuals to play I think he said something like the best that their bodies will allow them to play, or their beings will allow them to play, or something like that. And it's like, that's not great, because that's not going to happen that often, and when it doesn't, you're going to lose a lot of games. And I think that really speaks to sort of where the program is at. Were you surprised that OU lost at Hilton last night on Monday night?
No, I predicted them that they would, because it was almost like, you know, in the NBA there's scheduled losses, you know, coming off a back to back against a team, you know, that's been off or whatever. I thought it was like a scheduled loss almost. Yeah. I mean, to play at Gallagher Iba and get all you want in that game, and then just face the grueling team that is West Virginia, who's just in your face for the entire game, and they found a way to win that one. I just think they were kind of worn out. Now, I mean, it was a good game. They had every chance to win, but I wasn't surprised. And Iowa State was favored, and there's a reason for that.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was also only 2 weeks after the Classic in Lawrence, so.
Yeah, they just a brutal slate. You know, just this past couple weeks have been brutal.
I mean, does anybody besides Kansas have a chance to win the Big 12? I mean, I know West Virginia does. I know OU does. But do they have a real chance, do we think?
Yeah, I think OU does. And I think even Iowa State does, because I don't think Kansas is as good as they've been, you know.
But don't we say that every year?
We do, and I'm sure Bill Self's such a good coach, he'll find a way to win, and Perry Ellis will come back for a 12th year. But I'm not willing to say that no one else has a shot. I mean, I think OU is a really good team, and they had every chance to win in Lawrence. They could beat Kansas and Norman. So, no, I don't – I mean, the odds will definitely be in Kansas' favor, but I'm not willing to say that OU or Iowa State don't have a chance.
Well, and the problem with taking out Kansas in the Big 12 is that they're so much better than everybody else at home that you have to be – like, you can't really be equal with them, because if you're equal with them, their home court advantage kind of negates your equality. So you have to be, like – a little bit better or a lot better than them, and that hasn't happened, and I don't know you know, if it's going to this year. I mean, you look at even the OU game, like OU needed to win that game in Lawrence to kind of put them in the driver's seat for winning the Big 12. It's just they defend Lawrence so well.
They do, but if you think about it, they've been prone to slip up. We've mentioned the Oklahoma State games. Remember when they lost at TCU? Like that's the thing about Kansas. Yes, they're unbelievable at home, but they get everyone's best shot.
Yeah.
on the road, people get up for those games. Arenas that normally aren't full are full for Kansas when they come to town. So that's why I don't think it's a slam door or slam shut case that Kansas is going to win it. But the biggest takeaway I had last night watching OU and Iowa State is college basketball's fun again. Like, yeah. I've been down on it for the last, you know, because the basketball here in Oklahoma has been just pretty bad for the last 5-10 years. And now that OU's good, you kind of see just what it's like to watch a good college basketball game again. It kind of rekindled my love for college basketball, because it was dead in the water, really.
Yeah, no, it has been a lot of fun, other than Oklahoma State. But I feel like even nationally, like, it's been more fun for whatever reason. Maybe it's just because the Big 12 is really, really good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've enjoyed it this year.
Did you see, this is kind of OSU basketball related, since we've talked about Doug Gottlieb in the past. Did you see that UNLV has an opening, and Doug was interviewed by a radio host in Las Vegas, asked if he was interested in being the UNLV coach, and Doug, quote, absolutely. He's basically campaigning to be the coach at UNLV.
See,
is that no way saying, come and get me, OSU, before I take the UNLV job?
Well, it's interesting, because you think about, I mean, clearly he wants to be a head college basketball coach. I think people, like, don't realize the, like within college basketball, within basketball coaching circles generally, like, UNLV is an amazing job in terms of, like, all the high school basketball coaches, all the assistant basketball coach, college basketball coaches across all these different divisions. Like, there's a ton of people who want to be the UNLV head coach. Like we don't think of it in terms of being a really good job, because we see Kansas and North Carolina and all these places, but jobs are limited. And so I think that, like, of course he would want that job. He would want any job that's at that level, because he's not even in coaching right now. I mean, the leap from where he's at to that kind of job, I mean, people that are actually in coaching would kill for that, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's where Lon Kruger came from. I mean, he was at UNLV before OU, so yeah. It's a good job. And there's a poll on this article that I read. Should UNLV even consider Doug Gottlieb for the job?
Sure.
The poll results, 22% said interview only, 36% said no, but 42% said yes, hire him.
Wow, that's a lot.
The UNLV fans want Doug Gottlieb.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
That's very
That shows you kind of the, you know, it's not just an OSU thing necessarily, that he could be a viable coach at the next level.
I wonder how much money we could look this up, but I wonder how much money the UNLV coach was making. I mean, it's million and a half, something like that? More? Two million?
I would say 1.5 maybe.
Yeah. And I would think we're delving into some assumptions here. I would think that's more than Doug is making on his radio show and calling games for CBS and stuff.
I don't know. You're the one that works for CBS.
I know. I kind of backed myself into a corner there with
you probably have some sources there. Dave Rice was the UNLV coach. His base salary was $700,000 annually.
Wow, that's lower than I thought. And I, yeah, that's interesting, because here's my thing. I feel like I feel like Doug and people in his I mean, I feel like Doug's got a really cool job. I mean, I think that you and I would both agree with that. And I don't know that from a logistics standpoint, being a head basketball coach is a really cool job. I guess it is, but wouldn't you rather like kind of have Doug's job than be a head coach at a kind of good school? Unless you just really want to be and get into coaching.
Well, I think it's twofold. One, you really have to want to coach, and it has to be something that is inside of you, because we've seen coaches that no longer want to coach how much they enjoy doing TV. I mean, it's pretty easy. You get paid a lot of money. We've seen a lot of coaches, like Bill Cowher is one of the best coaches alive, and he hasn't coached for the last 10 years because he's like, man, this is pretty low stress.
Yeah.
Get to just make some money. But I do think that there's a competitiveness aspect that is just not there with TV. And these guys, you know, Doug played college basketball. I'm sure he misses being in that locker room environment when you come off a big win, that type of stuff. You can't replicate doing what he does now. And maybe that's what he misses. Maybe that's, and he, like I said, last podcast, we talked about him. His dad's a legendary coach. His brother's a coach. It's probably something that's in his blood, and he probably wants to give it a shot because he can always go back to TV. Like, let's think about it. OSU hires him. He flames out. There's a bidding war between ESPN and CBS.
Yeah.
Basically to get him. Yeah. We've seen that Steve Lavin's taken like 10 jobs and just come back to TV. You know, I think it's pretty possible that you could do both.
Yeah. It's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out. I'm shocked by that 42% that number.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really surprising. Not because I don't think Doug would be good, because I don't think that other people think that, or I wouldn't have said that coming in.
Well, so it's come a long way since, you know, this came up last time when he was coming up for, like, I think he was campaigning, I think, for the Kansas State job.
Yeah.
And people kind of just laughed it off. And if you brought up Gottlieb for the OSU job, people thought you were crazy. So it kind of shows you that it's not that crazy. People nationally think it's actually a decent idea.
Yeah. Okay. We got a couple other, we got a lot of other things that we want to just randomly get into. NFL playoffs, you've been watching?
Yeah, not super closely, but I've watched most of the games.
By the way, what did you think about, I posted this the other day, Mel Kiper thinks that Emmanuel Ogba will go at the end of the first round. He had him going to Carolina.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of surprising he was that low, but I don't claim to know enough about the other prospects in the first round. But
I would be surprised if he didn't go in the top 20.
You think so?
I mean, don't you feel like he's going to interview well and do pretty well at the combine?
Yeah, he's a character guy on top of just his physical attributes and his production too. And that's I probably agree with you, because pass rushers are like the first things to go in the draft. So I think if a couple go early, his chances of going well before 31 or 32 go straight up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's going to be really interesting. Him and there's a lot of guys that I'm fascinated to see where Treadwell goes from Ole Miss. If he goes, I think Kiper had him like 10th or something.
I bet he goes like top five.
He's a beast. But I mean, top five for a receiver? I mean, I just feel like with receivers and running backs, you see all these dudes, even in the playoffs, that you're like, I'd never even heard of this guy. Like, did he play in college? You know, and so
do you know where Antonio Brown went to school?
I probably should. No, it's somewhere random. Syracuse or something?
The Chippewas of Central Michigan.
There you go.
Who played Oklahoma State this year. Did you see any Antonio Browns when OSU was playing them?
No, I did not.
But yeah, that proves your point. Emmanuel Sanders, one of the better receivers.
SMU, wasn't he?
SMU.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's a weird deal. But you're right, but I think receivers that are like as physically dominant as him go pretty high.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so we got the final four. Our guy Brady.
I'm pacing around my living room, anticipating the Brady Manning matchup one more time.
So I was thinking about, and this is sort of relevant because, as I told you, I don't think I've made this public, but I'm covering the Super Bowl this year for CBS. I'm excited about going out to San Francisco. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really hoping that Brady's playing in it, because we're fanboys, we're super fans, the Uggs, the whole thing.
He's going home. That's where he's from.
But yeah, exactly. You can make a montage, and I'll play it for him at media days.
Cue up the picture of Brady in his Montana jersey as a kid.
But isn't the, I mean, we talked about this a little during Oklahoma State season. Isn't the Patriots offense like exactly like Oklahoma State in that they don't, they can't run. Like, and I was thinking about this weekend because Gundy was talking about how like, oh, we can't win 10 games next year if we can't run. Well, the best team in the NFL doesn't run. So maybe you need to figure that out, you know?
I totally agree. They came out and threw, what, 15 straight passes against the Chiefs?
Yeah.
Like, they have, they're down to, like, Brandon Bolden at running back, who's basically the, you know, the Raymond Taylor of OSU.
They have Steven Jackson. He's, like, 48.
Yeah, they called Steven Jackson out of retirement to come run the ball. But, yeah, you have to play to what – if you can't run the ball at all, like, just why are you even pretending? Now, they do have Gronk to throw to.
Yeah.
That helps. But, yeah, I totally agree.
Oklahoma State has Blake Jarwin.
I think you mean James Washington. That's a better comparison.
So who's – okay, so we got Patriots, Broncos this weekend, and Panthers, Cardinals. Who do you think is – what's the Super Bowl going to be?
I think the NFC is a lot better than the AFC. I think whoever wins the Panthers-Cardinals game will be favored in the Super Bowl. I think New England's so much better than Denver. I don't think Denver's very good. Now, they have a great pass rush. This is the only thing that kind of worries me as a Tom Brady supporter. That's the one thing that gives him trouble is a strong pass rush. Manning's a shell of his former self, but... And they're playing in Mile High, where that's not where the Patriots have played well in recent memory. But I think it's going to be, is this too cliche to say Panthers and Patriots, two favorites?
That's who I think too. I just don't see Carson Palmer going on the road in the playoff. I don't know. I mean, I know that Carolina's offense isn't that great. By the way, I didn't realize this, but I saw. I think it was on CBSSports.com, shameless plug there, that this is the first time two Heisman-winning quarterbacks have faced each other in the NFL playoffs.
Wow. That's
pretty,
a great stat.
That's pretty shocking.
Yeah, and Cam Newton's so much better than I thought he was going to be.
He's so good.
Like, did you think he was going to be this good coming out? I didn't think he could throw it like he does.
Yeah, I didn't. I think with guys like him, it's sort of like... They just think that they're a lot better than they actually are, and so they sort. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy a little bit. Like, I think he thought he was, like, the best quarterback in the NFL his rookie year, and and so he sort of grew into that over time. I mean, he's unbelievable, though. He's just so physically dominant. Like, he's so big, and he just, I don't know, he makes good decisions. He's
like Derrick Henry playing quarterback. It's, like, absurd.
Yeah, it really is.
But I really think this is setting up well for the Patriots. It's just I do worry about going to Mile High. I'm a little nervous about that game. I'm not gonna lie. The more I talk about it, the more nervous I get.
I like how you don't describe yourself as a Patriots fan, but just a Tom Brady supporter. I think that's probably where I'm at too.
Every time it comes up and people are like, oh, I hate the Patriots, and they're like, don't you? I'm like, well. I'm going to make a weird analogy here in a second, but like I don't like Belichick and the way he is, but I'm just – Tom Brady is probably one of my all-time favorite athletes, maybe the all-time favorite athlete, just because I think he's the best ever. I love his demeanor. I love everything about him. And the fact that – you know, there was this big argument over many years between him and Manning and him against anybody really. Who – like look at the weapons he's had to play with throughout his career. He finally has someone in Gronk other than like a one-year span of Randy Moss.
Where he threw 50 touchdowns.
He had a legit receiver and broke every record known to man. But in between that, he's thrown to Rashay Caldwell, David Patton. Just the Patriots have screwed him over time and time again with weapons, and he just still wins. And he's going to his fifth straight AFC title game.
He's played it. I saw this last weekend. He's played in. This will be his 10th overall AFC title game. That's insane. It's more than I think I saw like 27 teams have played in conference title games.
Oh, man. And just go back to the Super Bowl last year. He gets the ball with like, what was it, a minute and a half left?
Yeah.
Just bing, bang, boom, done, touchdown. You know, like just.
Yeah, number four.
And he's done that, and we've talked about this before, the two Super Bowls he lost, he led a game-winning drive, but the defense gave it up at the very end.
Yeah.
You can go both ways with that, with field goal kicks too. But my weird analogy for that is, it's kind of like Kanye West. Like, I love Kanye's music, but I don't really like him. That's kind of how I feel about Belichick. I like Tom Brady and I like the way they play, but I don't like Bill.
Yeah, that's good.
Have my cake and eat it too?
Yeah,
is that okay?
I like that analogy. I can't wait till you get called out in the comments section for being a front runner
by Nate.
Yeah.
Weren't we going to have him on the podcast at some point?
Yeah, open invitation.
Does he have the internet? Does he have a Skype?
Does he have the internet? I would imagine he has the internet.
I was trying to make fun of him, and that was a poor attempt. But we'll have Nate on at some point.
Okay, I want to talk about something else that is near and dear to your heart. I saw last week that Ohio State just signed a 15-year, $250 million deal with Nike. And
oh boy,
that was surprised. I mean, it seems like a lot of money.
It is a lot of money.
Well, yeah, it is a lot of money. And Nike signed Texas, Michigan, and Ohio State all recently, all for over. I think all of them were for over $100 million or $150 million. I mean, I know that these are valuable brands, but isn't that a lot of money?
It seems like an obscene amount. But you think about it; those are the three like highest sellers, you know. Like, they lead the country in merchandise and apparel purchases. So it's an investment, I guess. But I mean, it'd be more shocking to me if it was not an Ohio State or those schools you listed. I mean, those are the big boys.
Yeah,
if they sign Oklahoma State to some absurd Nike contract, then it would raise eyebrows. But I think, in order to keep those contracts and keep those big schools in the fold, you got to kind of overpay to get them.
Yeah. I'm really interested to see, and I need to look this up, when Oklahoma State's apparel deal runs out. Just because you've seen a lot of schools go to Adidas or Under Armour or whatever, and I'm fascinated to see if OSU would do that, or if, what the negotiation for that, or what the bidding war for that would be. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's a great move, because I think that there's some like underlying value in the recruits like Nike better than Adidas or whatever. I don't know. I mean,
what would you do, Kyle, if, let's say, Under Armour comes in and outbids Nike by just an obscene amount that'll like really make a difference for OSU? Would you be willing to sign that?
That would buy out Travis Ford?
Yes. Under those terms, would you be willing to rock the Under Armour?
I mean, me personally, I enjoy wearing Under Armour.
Well, would you like to watch OSU football wear Under Armour?
No.
Even if it was just an obscene, they throw just an absurd number at you, you'd stay loyal to Nike.
Well, what's an absurd number?
I have no idea.
Like twice, just, like
I don't know.
Like, let's say Oklahoma State's getting like $5 million. A year worth of gear and money from Nike right now. Under Armour comes in with how much a year?
Double.
10?
I think you have to.
Yeah. Though. Yeah. Yeah.
There's so much more of it out there now. I think back when, like, we were watching OSU basketball in the year 2000, there was like a lot more pride being Nike. Now, I'm a Nike guy, but now I think there's more teams that are Under Armour or Adidas to where it's not as uncommon.
Well, and more importantly, I think that, and this is going to sound really goofy, and I totally am a dad and don't know what I'm talking about right now, but I think that recruits think Under Armour's cool.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there's that like stigma there if you're like Russell Athletic or like even Adidas. And maybe it's just you and I that don't think Adidas is cool, but it doesn't seem like, I don't know. Has anybody done like a poll of like the ESPN 300 of like which brand they prefer?
No, but I'm willing to bet Adidas is behind Under Armour and Nike, though.
I would think so, too.
I think Under Armour's kind of past them as far as the coolness and all, and just their work uniforms and stuff. It's interesting though that Oklahoma State's been Nike for so long. Did you know that the wrestling team's Adidas because of John Smith?
Yeah,
he has like an Adidas contract and like his own like line of wrestling shoes.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting that you can be a Nike school, but like one of your other sports could just sign their own deal.
Well, there was a year, this was like pretty recently, 3 or 4 years ago, when Baylor had, they were like Nike football, Adidas basketball, and Under Armour baseball.
Yeah, that's right.
It was bizarre. It was, and I didn't realize the baseball thing until like the regionals that year, and I saw them playing, and I thought about it. But yeah, it's I don't know. I need to look that up and make that a post for when OSU's Nike contract runs out.
Oh, yeah. Are we going to talk about Making a Murder today or Thursday?
No, let's talk about it right now.
Okay.
Actually, I wanted to bring up. We're all over the place today, but I wanted to bring up Steph Curry. We haven't talked about him on the podcast, I don't think.
Oh, man. I have a theory about Steph that involves Bill Self.
Really?
Yeah, I think we've talked about it before. You probably know what I'm going to say. The year that Kansas won the national title, the year before or maybe during that season, Bill Self had for sale signs in his yard. He kept losing early in the tournament.
Yeah, you have told me this.
Kansas fans were fed up with Bill Self, and they play Davidson in the Elite Eight. And Steph Curry shoots a shot at the buzzer that hits off the glass and doesn't go in, and Kansas advances, and then Kansas ends up somehow coming back from 10 points down to beat Memphis, and they win a national title. OSU tries to recruit Self, but he's a made man at this point. He's won a national title. He's not coming.
Yeah.
Steph Curry makes that shot. Bill Self's been the coach at OSU the last 10 years.
But was it – yeah. Oh, gosh. Was it Curry or was it their point guard that shot the shot?
If it wasn't Steph Curry, then – the Davidson coach should have resigned the next day.
I'm pretty sure. Remember that white point guard they had that was so good?
No, I don't.
I'll have to look him up.
I don't remember anyone other than Steph on that team. But
the reason I asked that, I clicked on a Deadspin post today that said Steph Curry is rude as hell or something like that, and it was just him. It was just all these videos of him hitting shots from like near half court. And
he's incredible.
It's so fun to watch. I mean, it really is.
Like, he wasn't this good in college. Like, he was a really good college basketball player, but he just like transformed it into this freak, this superhuman marvel.
Yeah,
I can't even like comprehend it when I watch it.
No, I can't either.
And Simmons was talking about it on his podcast. He had a theory that, you know, Klay Thompson and Steph Curry are sons of NBA players, and they grew up at NBA arenas shooting on those rims all the time. Do you think that has kind of transformed them from just a really good NBA shooter to these just other world shooters?
No, I think it's less of that and more like the work ethic of like seeing what goes into being an NBA guy. Because everybody wants to be an NBA guy. Nobody really understands like what it takes or how good you have to be. Jason Richards was the point guard on that team.
Wow.
He averaged 12, 3, and 8 a game. I'm pretty sure he took the last shot, but it could have been Curry. That was one of my favorite NCAA tournament games ever.
What did you want to bring up about Curry? Just the fact that he's so incredible?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of random things to talk about that aren't Oklahoma State basketball.
I was ready for Making a Murder. I don't know about you.
Okay, let's talk about it. If you have not finished... if you're not watching, you might want to turn the podcast off right now because we're about to spoil the crap out of the 10 episode series.
Sorry to interrupt you. I just pulled up the last minute of Davidson, Kansas.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right. Steph Curry passed with like 2 seconds left and the little white point guard missed it. Great memory by you.
Yeah, well, here we are.
Sorry. Making a Murder. Spoiler alert. If you haven't watched it, turn it off.
Yeah. So I finished on Friday night, last Friday night, and I don't know how to feel. I have to say, I feel not, I don't feel fulfilled by the series.
No?
No.
Well, you don't get a good feeling when you finish it. Is it more of disgust, or do you feel,
no, what's just the feeling? It just felt like, there's a part of me that feels like it was so hyped by so many people I knew that I kind of got done and it was like, is that it? You know, like, there's nothing else, you know?
Yeah.
It was good.
Well, there's no way it could have lived up to the internet hype that exists.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was, you were glad you watched it, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. It was excellent, but it wasn't like that. I never watched an episode and felt like, oh my gosh, I can't go to bed until I watch the next episode.
Not even after they find the vial of blood?
That might have been, there might have been one or two, but I didn't feel like that after every single one, like I did with like a, I don't know, Breaking Bad or something like that. I mean, obviously those are very different shows.
Yeah, well, I think there's this prevailing narrative now that, you know, the documentarians or the filmmakers, whatever you want to call them, are coming under fire for not including certain stuff.
Yeah.
And I have, like, for everything that gets brought up, I have a rebuttal for everything. You posted an article from Shane Ryan that was very, very critical of the filmmakers. And I think there's a rebuttal to every point he had to make in that. They didn't include various pieces of evidence, but they also didn't include various pieces of evidence from the defense as well.
But the point is, not that there's theories that go opposite those, but why are they not putting them out there? Like why are they not defending their own work? I think that's more the criticism of the filmmakers than, hey, maybe there's not stuff to combat this.
Well, I mean, do they have to defend it every time they're interviewed? I mean, what's the protocol there?
Yeah, I don't know.
Do they have to like have all their fact sheet out from the entire case ready if someone questions them? I mean, I don't know. I think it's a little harsh, the criticism. They had 240 hours of footage. Like,
but how crazy is it that, like, I was thinking about this, you give up 10 years of your life to this one project. I mean, I get upset if, like, writing a blog post takes me over 10 minutes. And they give up 10 years of their life to this one project. And then they go to, I think I read they went to HBO, who turned it down. They went to PBS, maybe, who turned it down. And then I guess Netflix bought it. But, I mean, that's an insane thing to have given so much of your, I mean, not that it's wrong, but it's just crazy that they've been so deep in it for so many years.
I mean, I can't even imagine that. 10 years, yeah.
And moving to Wisconsin, and I mean, it's just, it's crazy.
Well, and when I go shoot like a story for Channel 5, like I have like, oh, you know, 10 minutes maybe of footage, and that just seems like so much to sift through. Like a 10-minute interview is like hard as hell to edit.
Yeah.
So I couldn't imagine having to edit 10 hours worth. That's just crazy. What's your biggest takeaways? What do you want to talk about involving
well,
the series?
Well, I want to talk about who we both think did it.
Okay.
So
here's my biggest problem. Let's say do you think Avery's guilty? Let's start there.
I do.
What evidence do you have to prove that he's guilty?
The bullet in the garage.
Okay.
The bones in the fire pit.
Mm-hmm.
The bullet came from a gun that was hanging over his head, which was, or over his bed, which was not presented in the documentary.
It came from a .22 rifle, which is the most popular rifle in America.
I love this.
Like it's the most.
I should have.
There are literally millions of those.
Like I actually think that he did it, but even if I didn't, I would have picked that so that I could hear all of your rebuttals.
And the bullet was found what, like 7 months later, like after they've swept the place clean.
I'm not saying that it happened the way. And this is my thing. It definitely didn't happen the way that it was presented in the trial. Therefore, he should be innocent. But I still think he did it. Because the other theories they're so far-fetched that he either did it or he's the unluckiest person of all time.
How are they that far-fetched, though? That someone set him up? I mean...
Yeah, I mean...
I think it's more far-fetched that he would burn a body right outside of his bedroom. And and the fact that they proved that the bones were moved from the quarry, like the big open space, like a mile from his place...
Yeah, that was interesting. And
the fact the fire was not outside his house was not hot enough to do what it did to those bones either.
My sister,
which was not included in the documentary.
My sister had a good point in that she was like, if you think he did it and there's not basically not enough evidence to clearly prove that he did anything, do you really think he's smart enough to have covered it all up the way that it was, you know, purported that he covered it up and make it look like he didn't do it? And I thought that was a good point because he certainly doesn't come off as someone who's intelligent enough to have used all these back channels and all these different things.
No, and an interesting point I've seen made by his attorneys is, you know, his phone calls have been recorded for hundreds and hundreds of hours since he's been in prison. His own attorneys claim that Steve Avery is not a smart enough person to have not incriminated himself by now. Like, just in certain little ways of discussing everything that's happened, like, he almost would have either confessed by now or at least incriminated himself in some way. And it's hard to imagine a person of his intelligence keeping up a lie that long and not incriminating himself in any way possible, even though he's being recorded every hour of the day.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I had not thought of that.
Yeah, and one thing, okay, my theory on who did it, again, this is just for fun, people. I'm not accusing anyone of murder. But I think it's pretty clear if you're going to point the finger at somebody else, it's got to be Scott Tadich, who is Brendan's father-in-law, the guy with the mustache that said it was the best thing in the world that Stephen Avery was convicted, though he's related to the guy.
Yeah, that was a really odd thing to say.
And Bobby Dassey's brother, Bobby, or Brendan Dassey's brother, Bobby, who lied on the stand about Steve Avery claiming that, hey, yeah, what, you want to hide the body? Like, joking around. He lied about when that took place.
Yeah.
And he lied about his alibi. The only alibis those two guys had were each other. And they were going, quote, hunting. And they saw each other drive past one another. Like, that's their alibi.
Yeah, that was weird, too.
And Bobby Dassey was found to have scratches on his back after all this happened. Like, and he claimed it was a cat. Like, that's fishy. And reportedly, Tadich left whenever Avery got first arrested for the murder. Tadich left work in a panic and tried to sell his .22 rifle to like a coworker or somebody, or to a friend. And none of which was investigated. But that's exactly what his bosses told him. So I think I went back and watched some of the courtroom stuff. Like, I watched the whole series, and then I went back to episodes like 3, 4, 5, 6, like right when they get all the arguments and stuff. And Avery's lawyers could not say someone else did it. You know, they couldn't propose alternative. But the way the documentary is filmed and shot, they basically do in the documentary, because they say, yeah, we can't come up with it. Then boom, the ex-boyfriend's up on the stand. We can't. Boom, then there's Bobby Dassey, and boom, there's Scott Tadich. So it's obvious they thought either the ex-boyfriend or Tadich or Bobby Dassey were involved. And when you go back and watch it, I think Tadich and Bobby seemed the most fishy.
Yeah, they did. Bobby, I think I compared him to, what did I say, Trooper Taylor levels of shady.
Trooper Taylor, that is a stroll down memory lane.
Just waving a white towel all over Manitowoc County.
Walking recruiting violation.
By the way, if anybody's still listening and understands that whole reference, we've got some real diehard OSU making a
no doubt
fans on our hand. But yeah, it's a good point. I feel like sort of my default in situations like this, where even with something like Serial, where it makes you feel like this person's getting screwed over, and you know they weren't given a fair deal and everything, and I feel like my default is to say, well, maybe, but the probability is that they did it. But in this case, you're right. Like, the evidence, at least that we saw in the documentary, like, it was at best, like, kind of linked Stephen Avery to the murder. Not even like it wasn't even. I mean, it certainly wasn't sufficient for convicting him. But the problem is that you know, the other theories are difficult to know because they weren't investigated, and that goes back to really the overarching thing in all of this is how badly the police department and everyone involved handled it.
They didn't even investigate the roommate and the ex-boyfriend after they didn't report her missing for like 3 days.
Yeah.
And they don't even investigate it.
And the thing that I feel like didn't get talked about enough was what was hanging over all of this to begin with, which was the $36 million. And yeah. it's almost like the motive here was never even discussed. You know, like what's the motive in all of these people's cases if you're going to put forth these theories? And well, the group or the organization with the greatest motive was the Manitowoc County Police Department. They're on the hook for $36 million. I mean, how come that
Sheriff's Department?
How come that didn't get talked about?
I know. I mean, they don't have $36 million. I'm willing to bet. So like everything was on the line for them.
Yeah.
And Steve Avery's going to do this when he's suing for 30 after he's been in prison for 18 years, and he's gonna kill someone when he's got $36 million coming his way. I find that hard to believe, but there is stuff that was not included. And the biggest problem I have with this case is, even if there's a legitimate piece of evidence, you can almost argue that it was planted, because there were certain things that were planted. Like the key was planted. Like, yeah, we don't even have to discuss it.
Right.
But like, there's, you know, reportedly that wasn't shown in the documentary, that Steve Avery's DNA was found under the hood.
Right.
Well, and that's just like the ultimate case of like everyone saying the filmmakers were biased and didn't want it included. But Steve Avery's attorneys got the guy to admit that found it, that he forgot to switch gloves.
Yeah.
And so and Kratz claims it's sweat. You can't even claim it's like sweat comes from like skin. So basically you just touch anything that's Steve Avery's skin cells and bam. So like, that's my problem is, like, even if that's a legitimate piece of evidence, you can also argue that it was planted. So it's just like the case was so skewed from the start with all their planted evidence that you can't even take like legitimate evidence seriously.
Yeah.
That was my biggest thing about it is, it didn't happen how they said it. Does he look guilty? Is there a possibility that he did it? Yes, but they didn't have enough to convict him for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think whether you think he did it or not, an intelligent person should be able to look at the case and say, no, they didn't have enough. Even like looking up stuff online that was presented in the courtroom. Like I saw an interview with Ken Kratz where he was like, you know, this was basically just two filmmakers trying to, you know, get you to feel a certain way. They didn't present it with any journalistic integrity. And it's like, well, even when you look up the stuff online, there still wasn't enough to convict him. Like it's beyond a reasonable doubt. And that was not there, even with the extracurricular evidence that, you know, everybody's looked up afterwards. It's just, I thought that was the really sad part, is that him and Brendan Dassey were convicted of things that it doesn't matter whether they did them or not. I mean, that's how the justice system works in the United States. That's what makes it so great. And it's just, I don't know. I thought that part was unfortunate.
The most unfortunate part of the whole deal is Brendan Dassey.
Like, jeez. Yeah.
He clearly had nothing to do with that, and was like, he thought he would just tell those police officers what he wanted. He can go back to school and turn in his project and watch WrestleMania and play PlayStation. Like, that's all he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And he got coerced into that. And I'm sorry, Kyle, I need to take a minute. I saw a blue ribbon. I had to take a moment myself here. The blue ribbon upset me very much. I thought the biggest villain of the whole piece was that O'Kelly guy that talked about the blue ribbon. And when they made him read those emails where he just destroyed the Avery family as a whole, and he starts crying and blames it on the ribbon. He was crying because he sent an innocent kid to prison.
He was crying because he was thinking he was going to get sent to prison after reading those emails.
Yeah. And apparently he didn't. And apparently Kaczynski, the guy that hired him, is like still he's like a judge or something.
Crazy Lou Holtz.
Yeah. Bizarro Lou Holtz. But the biggest villain, I thought, the whole thing was O'Kelly and Kaczynski.
Yeah. And I didn't, this was in episode, I think, 9. But making, or the decision to make Brendan Dassey take the stand was not a great one. I just felt like it went really badly for his defense once he took the stand.
Yeah, and I flipped on that. When I first saw it, I thought he did a good job because I kept expecting him just to admit he did it on the stand or something crazy. But then I went back and watched it again, and he never on the stand said he was coerced into anything. He just said, I don't know.
Yeah.
That was the big mistake. He should have stuck to his idea or his actual story, and that, you know, he was coerced into it. He goes just, and they didn't, and for some reason they didn't play the last 45 minutes or hour of the thing when he said, he told his mom on the phone that they got into his head, which I guess the defense thought that might be that construed as he was guilty or something. But
yeah, but I mean, he was in so deep that I don't even know if he knew what he originally thought or said or anything. I mean, legitimate, like you and I watching it, who are, well, some people would argue this, but who are not mentally impaired the way he appears to be, had trouble like sorting through it all. And so for him, I just feel like it was...
Yeah, and the hardest parts, and I skipped over these when I rewatched some of them, was when he called his mom from prison. Yeah. And that was hard to watch because it was so clear that he just had no clue what was happening.
Well, and seeing him age, they showed him at the
end. Oh, yeah, he gained like 200 pounds or whatever it was.
I mean, he looked like an old man. He looked like the movie Up in real life.
I haven't seen that in a while. That was a good movie.
Yeah.
One fact that I haven't seen written about or talked about anywhere that I didn't even realize until I went back and watched it. This is absurd to even say out loud. Brendan Dassey's first attorney, Kyle, was related to Teresa Halbach. He was cousins with Teresa, and he was his first attorney.
Wow.
And remember he gets replaced?
Yeah.
But you see him for like 10 seconds, and he doesn't even like defend Brendan. He just says, well, Brendan was coerced into doing this by this monster Steve Avery, and he's a minor and doesn't have a record. Like, that was his defense.
Yeah.
And then bam, they're like, oh, he's related to Teresa. He probably shouldn't be representing him. That just shows you the level of incompetency and corruption, really.
But the crazy part is that he probably would have done a better job than Lynn and O'Kelly did.
He may have. I mean, O'Kelly and Lynn were working for him, and they coerced a confession in which he drew pictures. Describing what he did.
That was appalling. And I think it's interesting because I think that we don't realize how it, and I don't mean this in a negative way if people who are listening are lawyers or attorneys, but I think that attorneys and people like they portrayed in the show, I think they collude more often than we actually realize. And I don't mean that like they're like in cahoots or whatever, but I think that they just talk back and forth and try to like help each other out in that, like within that world, more than the people who hired those attorneys actually realize.
You think that they work with the prosecution?
I mean, that's what they were doing. And I think that happens more than you would think.
Maybe it does. But remember Brendan's defense people, the advocacy group that comes in episode 10, who are like light years smarter than anyone we've seen in the documentary up to that point. They're all saying this is unprecedented that Kaczynski was like working with the prosecution. They were like just bumfuzzled by the whole deal. I don't know if that's a word. They were exasperated that Kaczynski would be working with the prosecution.
Like, well, that. I just remember, so when we were adopting our daughter last year, I remember like our attorney like talking with and like sort of like bargaining with the attorneys from the other side, and it was just like, it was really strange because I had always imagined this thing where they like didn't interact at all unless it was in the courtroom, and I don't know, I just think that stuff like that happens, and it's very odd to see as a normal civilian.
Yeah, I don't ever see that or whatever. But do you have any other theories? I have another theory. You got time for one more theory?
Yeah, let's hear one more theory. I think I've read a lot of theories online. I think the one that I like best is the first one that you put forth. I think I could be talked into that having happened. I just don't, I'm not totally sure the motive there in terms of why Bobby Dassey and Scott Tadich would.
Well, Tadich has a history of violence towards women. He's been convicted of stuff like that.
And maybe they were jealous of the fact that Avery was about to get paid or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think I saw a theory that, or maybe we talked about how Avery could have been sort of like dually framed by them and then also by the police department, both independent of each other. And so it looked like this huge, you know, grand plan, but it might have just been like, again, the worst coincidence ever for Stephen Avery to be convicted.
Well, yeah, and like it's like his lawyer said, he's like, one person could have done this, two people could have done this.
Yeah,
basically, because once they do their part or their crime, you saw just the levels that the police department went to make sure that it was Avery.
Yeah, that was appalling. But what's your other theory?
Well, the big thing in this whole deal that wasn't, I don't think, discussed enough was that the voicemails were deleted after her phone was destroyed and she was dead.
Yeah, I feel like that whole thing was like weird. Like it was sort of glossed over. Like, oh yeah.
And her okay. Yeah, her mailbox. Well, his defense team brought this up because that was one of their big. You know, Avery didn't do it, but somebody else did. The ex-boyfriend on the stand admits that he hacked her cell phone account
and guessed her password.
And guessed her password, which
like, that's preposterous.
That doesn't happen. Yeah. So and her mailbox was full, but then after, you know, 2 or 3 days afterwards, it wasn't, to where someone had deleted something.
Yeah.
Now, why would you want to go in there and delete, you know, voicemails? That to me is fishy. And obviously, I don't think Avery's good enough at hacking cell phones or passwords. So that to me is fishy. The ex-boyfriend didn't report her missing for 3 days. That's fishy. He couldn't remember if it was day or night the last time he saw her. Do you remember that?
Uh-uh.
He's on the stand, and Buting, I think, is just eviscerating him, like he always does. He's boss.
You're gonna get like a traffic ticket here in a few months, and you're gonna call Buting to represent you.
Buting and Strang will march down to the Oklahoma County and let him have it. But no, he says he's describing the last time he saw Teresa in great detail, that she was sitting at the computer or whatever. I mean, and actually, it's Strang, the one that's cross-examining him. And he says, well, what time of day was that? And he goes, I don't know. He goes, you don't know? He's like, no. He's like, well, was it day or night? And he goes, I don't. Yeah. I can't recall.
Yeah, I do remember that.
That's fishy. See? Yeah. But I think that's my second theory, and I think that's the only other person that possibly. And a lot of people are pointing fingers at the brother that was interviewed a ton during the documentary.
Yeah, he was weird.
Well, I thought they made him look bad, which I thought was a big gripe of mine I had with the series is, you know, this is a guy whose sister's been murdered, and he's obviously the spokesman for the family, and all these media coverages, you have someone that speaks every day like that.
Yeah.
And what's he going to say? Oh yeah, I think the cops, you know, I think the cops framed him. You know, he's sitting there listening to, now maybe he could have admitted, yeah, that's kind of fishy, but you know, whatever, but I don't know. I find his faith in the sheriff's department as being misconstrued as, you know, anything other than that. It was pretty disgusting. Although he did look, I say that. Do you remember the interview with the ex-boyfriend and him at the on Avery's compound when they're being questioned as to their whereabouts on the thing, and they both start like looking at each other, like making sure they got their story straight.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, he said strange things throughout all 10 episodes.
It's almost as if the police department said, here's where the car is, and we're going to make sure you find it, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And Avery didn't use a car crusher that was 10 feet away.
Yeah,
he just pushes a couple branches up against it. Are you kidding me?
Well, that was like...
Like, I mean, that's really hidden.
It almost would have been better without the branches. Like, if it was planted, which it looks like it was.
He puts a couple, leans a couple sticks against it.
Yeah, that was pretty bad.
Are you kidding me? And the lady finds it after 10 minutes of being on this massive compound.
Yeah, that was.
Oh man, it's
her, and her performance on the stand was Oscar worthy.
And then they cut right to Buting going, I never liked her.
He said something like, I mean, I don't. Like not believe in God or anything, like, but I just
that didn't happen.
But I just don't like her.
I don't like her. I never had a good feeling about her. I'm not saying. And then the guy was like, "Well, I guess aliens could have taken it." And he goes, "There were no aliens in the room, right?" He like made him clarify there was no aliens there.
Yeah, it was a great series. It was fascinating to watch, and you know, I think that it.
I think everyone should watch it just because it sheds a light on the justice system and how imperfect it can be.
Yeah, and it makes you further realize, if you didn't already, that innocent people they plead guilty. Like, I mean, or not plead guilty, but they confess. They innocent people confess things that they didn't do. I mean, I don't think does anyone think that Brendan Dassey did anything? I don't think they do.
No,
And stuff like this happens, and it's sad, and it's you know, I think the difficult thing for me is like, what is the what is my response to, like, what do I do about this? Like, is there anything to do? You know, like, is there, like, it doesn't really change the way that I live my life. It just makes me more aware of things that happen around me, I guess.
Yeah, I think that too. And it makes you realize that I thought Strang, who's this, the most eloquent person I think I've ever heard speak.
Yeah.
He made a great point in that, you know, a lot of us are lucky enough to go through life without committing a crime. But that doesn't mean you can't be accused of one.
Yeah.
And he's like, once you're accused, you've basically already lost.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of how much.
Yeah. I thought Chuck Klosterman brought up a really good point. I was listening to him talk about this, and he was like, just literally never talk to the police. Like, just like literally say no words to them and get a lawyer and figure it out from there. And I thought that was, I mean, that's smart. I think, I don't know.
It's funny you mentioned that because as I told you, I went on a deep dive on Reddit in the weeks following.
Yeah.
And someone posted a really great YouTube clip of this police officer at a college speaking to, you know, a classroom of students. And he was just describing to them how he gets confessions and how he goes about his job. Like, it was frightening.
Yeah.
how good he is at getting people to admit what they did wrong, or even people that didn't even admit they did anything wrong, just to get someone in the fold that, you know, they think did it.
Yeah.
And I think the title of the clip is "Don't Talk to the Police."
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
So it was interesting.
Okay, Carson, we will be back on Thursday. I think we're talking some Cruton.
Some Cruton?
Yeah, I told my wife this morning that I call it Cruton sometimes. And she said, "You sound like you're an OU fan who never went there. That's embarrassing that you call it that." So I might have to change that to start calling it recruiting.
That's a recent thing, isn't it? The Cruton.
Yeah, but I feel like it's
slogan.
I didn't like come up with it. Like it's.
No, I know it's like a Twitter thing.
Yeah, it's like a national thing.
No, I love it. It still makes me laugh when I read it in print. C R O O T I N apostrophe.
Yeah, Cruton.
Cruton.
Yeah.
Well, we need to talk some Cruton. I saw you did a chat today on pistols firing.
So yeah, we will. I need to
cap some of that.
I need to double check with Kyle Boone, but we're planning on having him on Thursday.
And by the way, you can't just call him Boone. I assume you're talking about Boone Pickens.
I know, it's so bad.
He wrote in one of your things, like, I laughed when Boone said this, and I was like, oh, what'd Boone Pickens say? It's like, Boone Pickens is talking recruiting?
Well, that would be amazing. We need to have Boone on to talk recruiting.
He should do a little Cruton.
Yeah, he should. Okay, Carson, we will talk to you on Thursday.
All right, buddy.
Okay, bye.